we've had pretty strong testimony that in many, many cases, I won't say each stream, but in many, many cases, we've over-appropriated water rights. That's been the overwhelming testimony. Doing that, we have continued on a policy, the legislature, at the legislature's acquiescence of issuing continually more permits. More permits. So then, we've got to find some way that if we feel that we're going to establish these minimum stream flows, some way, say, okay, while we're doing this, you may issue permits, but they aren't going to necessarily have perpetuity to them until we've determined what that minimum stream flow from this point forward. And I guess what I get from you is, and it bothers me just a little bit, because what it's saying is that we can't do that. That it just simply, this will jeopardize a number of irrigation projects, but if those irrigation projects indeed could affect the minimum stream flow and affects others' rights in the long run, it doesn't make much sense to continue on the same road of issuing those type of permits infinitum when we really don't know what the stream flow should be, should it?
Well, Mike, the way I would answer that is that let's assume for a moment that 225 passes. It's going to take, in my opinion, some time for the Water Policy Review Board to collect the data to establish a minimum stream flow that is adequate, that makes sense, not politically, but makes sense. Okay, now we have a...
Well, I think it's going to have to make sense from a sense standpoint as well as political sense, because there's no question that this hasn't been controlled politically before, and it's going to be controlled politically after. But I agree that we're going to make sense.
Well,
let's go ahead.
When you have agencies of the state, city, county, or others coming in proposing different minimum stream flows on different streams or sections of the stream, I don't think anybody in their right mind is going to spend the money for a project until they know exactly how much water is available to them. And you're going to be dealing with 2 or 4 years for the initial, we'll say, 73 streams. I don't know if the Water Policy Review Board is going to have time to act on these. Sure, they're important. So we're looking 4 or 6 years down the road. And from that standpoint, I don't think anybody is going to say, I'm going to gamble, and I'm going to spend the money today to irrigate on a new project.
Well, what troubles me with that, and I I'm troubled by this whole thing, what I've heard the last 3 or 4 months, what troubles me with that if we follow that rationale, is that if we don't do this, and they go ahead and they get all these permits, it's okay too. And then the legislature is faced with a dilemma that we got to go back and say, hey, it wasn't okay. And the city merely proposing this doesn't mean it's going to be agreed to. I mean, all it's saying is that at least they can identify their concern with their water resource. And I can see a number of cities that could be concerned, and for that matter, even watersheds. You could have a county concerned with this type of thing.
I understand that fully. But when you take 6 years waiting for the determination to be made, nothing happens.
Let me ask you the question. Do the citizens of this state, not the users who are irrigating, but do the citizens of the state who are trying to look at water resources, not for a single user source, but for a total resource, as a property of the entire state, and how we allocate this, do we have some rights too? How long have we waited? And there's an abundance of testimony, at least I think, that shows that we haven't done it very well. We don't even have updated basin studies. They've been denied, the department has been denied adequate funds to get a database and to get proper data processing. And there's been some evidence that this has been pushed or kind of put to the side simply because people really don't want to come to grips with a difficult issue. And I can tell, I know it's difficult for agriculture, it's difficult, I think, for the legislature to sit down here, but what really troubles me about this whole thing we've gone through is that we aren't prepared to say at a time when there isn't the pressure on us, there isn't the same amount of pressure because of the downturn in the economy, that we could get this straightened out in such a way that people don't lose property rights that they've had over the years, I worry more about that than saying, instead of playing dog in the manger, I'd rather get it out in the open, expose it, see where it is, and try to allocate it fairly than just ignore it. I can't see where this, in anyone, is going to jeopardize anyone other than the fact that it alerts them before they start investing money in something. That by George, they better see that, that there is a concern, and they could jeopardize instead of going ahead and buying into it, not knowing again, and the legislature produced the problem 6 years from now, we got to reverse it, take it away. That's no fun either. And so, anyway, I didn't mean to give you a bad time, but you know I'm exercising.
Oh, I know that, and I agree with you that the approach has to be balanced.
Okay.
I agree with that, but the data has to be there also.
Tom, are you concerned, are you concerned with both or any or all parts of this amendment in terms of sub three? I know you don't like junior, you know. I guess I'm asking whether you're concerned with people kind of bringing in and filing lots of streams.
We suspect that will happen.
Would it be helpful to you if we amended the line 7-8 and made sure that they had to go through the Department of Fish and Wildlife or the DEQ or the Water Resources Board on their own motion before you got a stream made? And at that point, it becomes less onerous, like you're not getting capricious kind of filings.
That would help the bill. We have said we supported 225, and I believe we will continue to support that.
So you support this bill if we were to make that change?
I don't believe we would support the bill. It does make it better, but I have to tell you, I do not believe the organizations I represent in agriculture would support
it. I understand. I want to ask you just one question concerning it. We asked Mr. Sexton this on Friday, I believe, and the argument that a minimum streamflow application that has not yet been approved will cloud the question of further appropriators. Don't you have the same situation with the water right? The water right is maybe approved in 60 days, but the certificate isn't. And that could be for a large amount of water. And doesn't that, in a way, cloud? Cloud the rights just in the same
Chairman, as I recall, though, there are time limits for which the department must act. I think it's part of that is 60 days to do the surveying and so forth. From that standpoint, we have not had any problems of those rights necessarily being clouded. There could be that situation if there were a number of permits, we'll say filed within a certain time period, a close period of time. But I don't know of anyone that has come to us to say that we have had a problem with the department because we thought we had a permit or a certificate for X amount of water to be drawn from a certain river or stream.
Mr. Chairman.
Same day.
I'd like to have you examine a proposal Senator Cohen made, and I'd ask the chairman maybe just not to send the bill to the floor for a couple of days and let us know, because if that would be helpful, I would be happy. I want to be constructive. I will tell you that I'm not satisfied we're going to come to grips with water policy this session, and that concerns me. But I'm willing to try, and in deference, since I got to carry the bill, I will hold it up a couple of days, if you will. If you take a look at it, if you have some suggestions, maybe Friday you come in and offer them to us, okay?
We'll be happy
to do
that.
Is that a fair deal?
That's a fair deal. The only thing, and Mr. Chairman, I appreciate the opportunity, is that we've talked about upstream storage, and let us never forget that if we're going to put water into a stream year-round, that's the way we're going to do it.
Well, Mr. Chairman, there were some of us that would have liked to have written a comprehensive bill that would have addressed that as well as other things, and that didn't work out. And I agree with you. I agree that...
Yeah,
we got it coming up. Well, and I'm willing to address that too, okay? Because I'd like to see, once these studies done, instead of just willy-nilly giving funds, and they've got something like $50 million of bonding authority for irrigation this biennium, I'd love to see that earmarked for improvement and enhancement of those streams we find in the most difficult, and prioritize it like we do in DEQ, Mr. Dewey. I think that should be done, but I'm having to deal with this in a piecemeal. I'd have had one bill for you that would have tackled all of it, And I'm not sure we're going to get any of it at this point, but I think your point is well taken. If we're going to say, okay, these are real problems, and how do we help it, then we ought to allocate what resources we have to those that will receive the, you know, the most improvement from up storage and what have you. And I agree with you.
And if I may, one more time. Throughout the water issue, it appears that the irrigators have been the bad guys in the issue. And let me tell you that those that are irrigating right now are trying to find ways to reduce their water intake because of the expense. They are becoming more and more efficient. And let us not forget what it does to the viability of the economy of the state.
Yeah, Mike, I just want to say that the reason, and I've told this to you privately too, the reason that I tried to separate 225, which is something that the agricultural community feels comfortable on, from the issues in 223 and 1.2 is because I think they're separate. I appreciate your position, and I would not expect that your organization to turn around and begin to endorse 223, and I wanted them dealt with separately so that hopefully we could at least have one area of agreement in this session. And I don't want to use this committee to bottle those bills up because I do think they're legitimate public policy debates that should take place on the floor, and I would expect them to rise or fall on their own merits.
But appreciate that.
I would move that we rescind the action by which we sent 223 to the floor. Without objection, it will be for us, so we will deal with that Friday, and we'll hear back from you then.
But Mr. Chairman, I'm firm about Friday being a deadline to get this out, and either in the shape that the motion was made today, or, you know, if, and it's really, as far as I'm concerned, up to Senator Day, whether we think we're going to gain anything by re-amending it.
I'd like to see Mr. Dewey consider some amendments that he thinks necessary, and I'll go and have them drafted for him if he has them.
We will be in conference, and I will do the special.
Same goes for Monday, Mr. Chairman. I haven't had a chance to look at the whole agenda, but if you have certain things on impoundments, constructively, we want to do that too, okay?
Okay.
I just disagree, and without too much belief, I would like to see it one, but we'll live with it. We'll make it piecemeal at a time, and if we can put together a constructive policy, let's work at it, okay?
I don't want to wait any longer, though, on Friday.
I'm talking about a different bill.
Okay, thank you, Mike.
Thank you.
Work session,
I got your message.
226.
The lecture.
We have Senate Bill 237 finally back from council, and I'm going to run through that for the committee briefly. And then you can take it home and browse it. Mr. Brenner, could you come up and run through that?
This is the same one you gave
me yesterday.
Yeah. Okay.
And then, John, work session is what? Or we're not taking action?
No, we're not taking action on it today. I just wanted to run through it and see if there's any questions on.
With Go East Section, I've got some notes I might want to throw at him to think about, okay?
Okay.
The rest of it.
As we go along.
I haven't given much thought to this, but now I've given thought to it.
All right. Dick, I wonder if you could breeze through the draft. We trimmed this down quite substantially from the bill as it was introduced, and we'll have Dick run through it, and then if you have any questions, just we'll just stop him at that point. Yeah.
Just, Mr. Chairman, the amendments for the bill as it's written?
Dash 6, 237A-6, the amendments. I think you have a copy of that. Sure, I have a copy of it, but we'll make.
I've got an extra copy, Dick. You got one?
I do. It's okay. 237A-6, isn't it?
Yeah.
531A. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Richard Benner, staff attorney with 1,000 Friends. The first thing I believe that was done from the Ann Gross version is the format of the definition of marginal lands was changed on the suggestion of legislative council to make it a little bit more readable. And now, if you look at Section 2, starting on line 10, well, Section 2 directs the Commission to amend the goals to do three things, basically. The first thing, starting on line 10, is to define agricultural lands in a certain way. And most of what you see there following in paragraph A is a repeat of what is in goal 3, the definition of agricultural lands in goal 3. However, when you get down to line 23 on page 1, it says excluding. That language is new. That is not in goal 3. That is, when I say new, it's been in the marginal lands bill, but it's not in goal 3. And the intent here, I think, is to clarify and to incorporate commission actions over the years on acknowledgement reviews and some case law, indicating that you don't have to apply goal 3 to land that is incorporated within urban growth boundaries. On line 26, there is case law saying that land need not be treated as agricultural land if it's already physically developed, even if it's outside of an urban growth boundary. On the top of page 2, if it's committed to non-farm use, it need not be treated as agricultural land.
Right here, I would suggest that we look very hard at the word irrevocably, and based particularly on the exception process that we looked at, what have you. I just call your attention to that, and I think that at a later time we may want to see what we can do to work out, and I just call it attention at this time without...
Thank you.
And then on line 3, you come to paragraph B, and that is an authorization for local governments to designate land, agricultural land, land that meets the definition of agricultural land, as marginal land, if they choose to, if no exception has been taken for it, and if it meets the definition of marginal land. And what follows from lines 7 through 20 is the same basic definition of marginal land that we've been, that you've been dealing with all along.
Brenner, I've gone through that and looked at that a little bit. And let me give you an example that I think get bothered. And it's too liberal as far as I'm concerned. I know that would surprise you, but when you look at class 5 through 8 soils, and you say, look, we're putting an income test on there, I guess I could go over Eastern Oregon and take a sizable farm, decide I don't want it to have an income, lower the income, and then I'm ready for Christmas Valley. The reason I bring this up for your attention is that that whole definition of the acreage size and income, all the testimony we received, you can work either way. You follow me? You could almost reward someone who isn't industrious. Now, I have a suggestion that I want you to think about a little bit, is that before we go in that type of approach, maybe we should give a broad definition of or a delegation of authority to the commission to develop marginal lands, because that income test, I think, can work both ways. I give that thought to you because all I do, one of the reasons we had land use today is the fact that we had folks in certain areas deciding we were going to sell land by a lot in the newspapers and what have you. And the way I read this, if I were to be in, you know, use a little ingenuity, I could, under the income, I could lower the income, be qualified, and I could get Katie by the door on 20 and 40 acre sites. It would be just dandy, okay?
So, Dave,
you know what I'm telling you?
I think I understand what you're saying.
That's why I read the test.
The way this is written, that is lines 7 through 9 on page 2, you look at the gross income produced by a parcel of land in 3 of the 5 years preceding the effective date of the Act. So when the Act passes, someone can't then make a decision to be unproductive, not produce $20,000, and qualify as marginal land. It's too late.
I think it's too late.
It's too late. The Act asks local governments to look back in time.
What are how they handle it in the future time?
Well, land that qualifies as marginal land is land that didn't produce $20,000 in 3 of the 5 years.
Five years now that it doesn't produce that. Can it qualify?
Well, it would not qualify as marginal land. It would have to be handled in some other way.
I guess what I'd say is, just call the committee's attention, I'm not sure that I wouldn't be more comfortable this acreage and what have you, and the approach, that you might want to give a delegation of authority to the commission to hold hearings and develop a formula for marginal lands. I'm not sure that both income and acreage is the best way you want to go, but I just offer that as a suggestion, okay? Your point's well taken. You feel you've stopped it by saying that nothing's going to qualify in the future without some additional act. This would take care of what happens at this point in time, okay? Thank you.
So, Amy? Very good question. The validation for an income test would be what? Tax statement?
I think that's one way of handling.
And a particular smaller acreage within a larger parcel, et cetera, you're going to be able to prove that X acreage did in fact not produce the $20,000 limit.
That's right.
Versus the surrounding area.
That's what a landowner, that's one way that a landowner could handle it. When we, Agriculture for Oregon, asked the planners and our staff to do some field testing of this definition in selected counties, and one of the questions that we asked extension agents, for example, in counties is, after having identified some land that was class 5 through 8, we would talk to farmers, ranchers, extension agents, county planners, whether the areas that we had identified were part of farm operations producing $20,000 or more in gross income. And what we learned from them is that in most cases it was very easy for them to tell because they were already aware of those areas. They had been controversial for one reason or another, and they knew that they were not part of farm operations. They were lying idle, or they just knew. They know their counties fairly well. Now, that doesn't mean that's going to be that easy in every case. There are going to be some cases where the land is going to be part of a farm operation that's producing something near $20,000. And then I think you're going to have to rely on tax statements or some other tangible form of evidence of income.
Mr. Chairman, pardon me, are you done, sir? I would appreciate, I've asked the department to review this draft exclusively. They did not have the benefit of your field testing, and I'd like to have you furnish that to Elton Hout, because I've asked for him to run a review of that and give us a little more of an analysis, and I would appreciate it if you could do it as soon as possible.
We can do that.
All right, thank you.
Okay. The rest of what you see on page 2 is unchanged from the A. and Grost version. They, just to explain to you what they are, starting on line 21 of page 2 and going on to page 3, those are the uses that are authorized on lands that qualify as marginal lands. There was a change starting on line 16 of page 3 from the A. and Grost version, and that was, there previously was a long paragraph there that said that this new authorization to use this concept would be available to counties only after their plans had been acknowledged. And there's some testimony and some, in fact, some comments made by Senator Hurd that perhaps counties that have not yet been acknowledged ought to be able to take advantage of this concept prior to acknowledgement. So lines 16 through 19 are written now so that a county such as Klamath County that has not yet been acknowledged can take advantage of this concept if they choose to.
Well, Mr. Chairman, the way that's written, I have some concern. I'm sorry Senator Hurd isn't here, but that it almost acts as another acknowledgement process. And I'm not sure that's necessarily the policy we want to follow or what he was getting at, but I point out to you the way that is written almost appears that we got to go through another acknowledgement process for this. I'm not sure that's what we intend, okay? I'm not sure that's what we intend.
Well, Senator Day, the point at which a county would propose changes to their plans or make changes and then propose them to the commission for review would be at the time of acknowledgement, which they would do anyway,
okay,
or at the time of a plan amendment, which would go before the commission
okay,
anyway.
Okay, but I guess what I'm saying is I'm not sure we necessarily want this to be a plan. Why can't they bring it under periodic review if they choose to do so?
They can do that.
I don't read it that way, so I'll just put it aside. You think about it, we'll talk about it, okay? I think this establishes a separate acknowledgement process required there, and I don't think you intend that, but let's talk about it somewhere, okay?
Beginning on line 20 in page 3, that is the language that describes when a lot of record, when there's a lot of record, and that has been restructured somewhat, but there's no real substantial difference from the A. Engrost version. There is a change on page 5, section 3, subsection 2, starting on line 4. You may recall the testimony about that provision in the law that authorized attorney's fees in certain circumstances in which a court determined that a use in an EFU zone was basically illegal. And it was changed. The committee asked that it be changed so that not just the petitioner, but whatever party prevailed would be eligible for those attorney's fees, and that the circumstances in which those attorney's fees could be awarded was limited to dwellings that had been approved as hardship dwellings and were not now being used as hardship dwellings.
Mr. Chairman,
sir,
just one little change there. I don't want to make this a relief act for the attorneys. It says shall. I would leave the discretion to the court and change that shall to may, and that's let the court decide. I don't think we ought to automatically mandate that, though the attorneys of the world would love this. I just point that out. I don't want to hurt your feelings, Mr. Brenner, but not all things in life ought to flow to the attorneys.
Well, I have very little stake in that, as I'm not eligible for those
things.
That.
I know that. Go ahead.
Let's see. On line, on the same page, on line 11, I believe I see missing the clause that was intended to be added to public or private schools.
No, it's on
the next page.
It's on the, it's there. Maybe your copy doesn't have it. Mine does.
It's on page 5, line 11.
Page 5, line 11.
Okay, it's not penciled into my...
Okay, it's there.
Okay, it is there.
Just like the Constitution.
We have a link. Okay.
Okay. I don't think there are any other changes from the A. Engrost version on page 5.
Could I ask you one question on G, please, if I may? Am I going to be able to have a farmhouse on these lots? Am I going to be able to continue on building an additional farmhouse if I need it for my home on a farm under the G?
G authorizes a dwelling on a parcel or lot that is managed as part of a farm unit that is as large as the minimum lot size if the county has one.
What if we don't have a minimum lot size? My point to you is not all...
And this doesn't help you. Then you go to the next subsection.
Are we mandating a minimum lot size for the counties?
Oh, no. No, no.
All right. Will you look at that again? I'm not sure, okay? Not sure, okay? So take a look at it, will you?
As I understand your question, you're wondering about the second dwelling if it's needed?
No, I'm worried about the second dwelling if it's needed. I'm worried about, are we telling counties that don't have a minimum lot size, they got to have one? Are we going through the back door on the county?
Well, the answer to your first question is,
no.
As long as the lot or parcel on which the farmer wants to put the second farm dwelling is part of a farm that is as large as the minimum lot size, and as long as the farmer can demonstrate there's a need for the second dwelling, yes, it's authorized.
Now, my second question is, are we through the back door mandating a minimum lot size to counties that don't have one?
No, we're not, Senator Day. There may be some slight encouragement to counties to use a minimum lot size because it's administratively easier to deal with dwellings in this fashion, but there's nothing
all
to do with
it. All I ask you is just take one more look at that and give us reassurance on it, okay? Because I have some concern that we may be doing that, particularly in counties that don't have it, okay?
All right.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
On page 6.
Dick, could you just because it's been a while, as you go through, would you indicate not just the changes from the A. Engrost, but the changes from...
Existing law.
Yes.
I apologize, Mr. Chairman. Okay. I've lived with this a long time.
All right, on page six, beginning on, well, there's a small change from existing law on line eight, and that is an authorization basically for counties to adopt their own conditions and standards for farm dwellings or other uses that are authorized by this part of 215. Then on line 10, lines 10 through 24 are the criteria for farm dwellings that don't involve a land division. This is really a companion to the provision that Senator Day and I were talking about. If a county does not have an acknowledged minimum lot size, this is the process it follows for review of farm dwellings, lines 10 through 24. Now what this says, if I can abbreviate it somewhat, is when an application is received, a county determines whether or not the parcel or the farm of which the parcel is a part is 20 acres or more. If it is, then it looks to see whether the parcel or the farm or the woodlot of which it is a part is as large as or larger than the average farm or the average woodlot in the county that produces $2,500 or more in gross income.